From the KUNV studios in Las Vegas, you're listening to Our Metropolis, a weekly interview program with people who are changing the face of Las Vegas. And now, here is your host.
I am John Katzlamitas, and I'm your host. I write the Katz Report on the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly websites, and I'm a columnist in the Las Vegas Sun print edition 3 times a week on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Our guest this week is an icon in the Las Vegas TV broadcast industry. For 36 years, he worked at KLAS Channel 8, first as a reporter, anchor, and finally as the CBS affiliate's news director. Last year, he came out of something that looked like retirement to accept a position as executive vice president of one-time KLAS rival KSNV Channel 3, the NBC affiliate in Las Vegas. He has lived here in Las Vegas since 1958 and is passionate about Las Vegas and has worked to preserve its history. Welcome to the show, Bob Stoldall.
It's nice to be here.
How's it feel to be an icon?
Well, I was trying to see if is that an acronym or is that actually a...
That's lowercase.
Lowercase, okay. I've been called lots of things, but there's the first time an icon.
If it's an icon, we can create all kinds of different titles for you, right? Before we talk about Las Vegas and your history here and all that you've done here, you were just in Cuba recently, right?
This about 2 or 3 weeks ago, actually, and we had an opportunity that came up relatively quickly. It was part of a humanitarian mission. Mm-hmm. Jim Rogers and several members of the Channel 3 team, along with Jim Snyder, we went mm-hmm. over there, along with the Jewish Federation, to deliver some needed medicine to this one young man who had cancer and developed an infection and needed this very specific medicine that was donated by St. Rose.
Okay, so under what circumstances were this medicine delivered, and exactly where why?
It was in Havana, okay. And the Jewish population there, which was about 15,000, 15 to 20,000 before Castro, dropped within 3 or 4 months to about 1,500, which is the population mm-hmm. now.
But 1,500 Jews in all of Cuba.
That's correct.
Today, okay.
And that's almost double what it was 3 or 4 years ago. It's a community that's alive and well and is growing. And it has a pharmacy within one of the synagogues or in that general area in the same building. And it services not just the Jewish population there, but the neighborhoods that they are as well. Several years ago, after... the Russians abruptly left Cuba. And by the way, the Russians are despised in Cuba.
Is that right?
For a couple of reasons. Leaving abruptly, mm-hmm. and then their architecture that they left behind. You will hear that comment time and time again about the architecture of the Russian embassy. And the architecture, that's one of the sad things about Havana and likely most of Cuba, is the beautiful, amazing architecture from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and at that point it was frozen, and it has been decaying mm-hmm. in many areas. But it's just one neighborhood after another. If you sort of squint and look at the architecture, it looks like Frank Lloyd Wright, and that's the only architecture I can think of off the top of my head, designed the building. But many of them, of course, are mission design and mm-hmm. various other. But it's just, it's beautiful. But the challenge is, it is really decaying. But we went over there as part of a humanitarian mission, not as journalists, mm-hmm. but it's hard not to make an observation. And, you know, we brought along our little cameras. I didn't bring along our big news cameras, brought along uh-huh. our small ones. And we took some pictures. And
just stills?
Just some stills, and I have my little flip cam.
Okay.
Took some mm-hmm. some video. And when we got back, we just looked at the stuff and said, you know, we're going to throw on some our observations. And then we started to do some more research. But one of the things we found out was that Las Vegas, in its own way, ripped Cuba off.
Oh, how?
And not the other way around. The shows that were going on in Havana in the 40s, these stage productions, mm-hmm. Are the ones that moved to Las Vegas in the 50s.
That was sort of the DNA of the showgirl and that type of entertainment? Is that what we're thinking of?
Yes, and the big extravaganza, uh-huh. you know, like the Follies kind of.
Right, I'm thinking Follies, I'm thinking Jubilee today, those, right.
Exactly.
Lido Deeper, even though it has
And there is one show that is still there, the Tropicana. And that, of course, was the home, as was the Riviera, of several organized crime figures, Meyer Lansky and that crew. And Meyer Lansky, in many ways, brought Cuba to Las Vegas when they got kicked out of Havana in the with the revolution.
Right.
So we decided to do a story on that, and so you're going to see you would have seen that last night, and we've got a series all this week running on Channel 3 at 6 o'clock that Jim put together. Just a fascinating community.
Well, take us through the series. We'll see tonight's installment will be.
Well, tonight you're going to see over the next 4 days, you're going to see one of the things that once you get off the plane, and by the way, there was no issue. We got on the plane in Miami, flew over there, put our passports down, did the whole thing, done, gone, not a big deal. One of the first things you realize is the rest of the world is vacationing in Havana and in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Canadians are down there, and by the way, if you're going to go down there, exchange your money into euros or Canadian dollars before you go. You trade your U.S. dollars down there. Castro charges at 20%. But for the rest of the world, it's only $10 or 10% of the. And then the second thing you notice are all the American cars that are there. Pre-1956.
I've heard this as if it's frozen in time.
Yes.
That they're mid-50s models cars still being driven around today. They're all in good condition.
And well, yes and no. I mean, some of them are pristine. Others have been used for the last 50, 60 years, and you can imagine. Mm-hmm. But the reason that they are still running, you are allowed to buy and sell those cars. Those are pre-revolution cars, so therefore the ownership, you can transfer the ownership. Post-revolutionary cars, have to go through a tremendous amount of problems to get it. So the one of the jokes in Cuba is you can get another wife, but you can't get another car. And you will hear that joke several times. It's like one of the you tell the Westerners that joke. But they are amazing. It's just and a lot of General Motors products for those vehicles.
Yeah, in the photos I've seen, the recent photos anywhere in Cuba, there's a lot of like Chevrolet Bel Airs and Nomads and those types of cars. And there wouldn't be a single Chevrolet Malibu, but
the newer cars you're going to see are North Korea. Mm-hmm. The newer buses you're going to see are China. When you turn the television set on, you will get two channels from a Chinese television, a Spanish version, and an English version.
Are not the two countries, Bob, if I can jump in, trying to relax these restrictions pretty actively right now? Am I right about that? Isn't President Obama and Raul Castro
compared to a few years ago, the answer would be yes. Uh-huh. Is it moving as fast as some folks would hope? The answer is no. You talk to now again, being in Cuba for 5 days, that's the context, and reading a lot beforehand, talking to as many people as we could at the time, and doing more research afterwards, still does not make me anywhere near an expert. These are strictly observations.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn little things like, while the cars you can buy and sell pre-Castro cars, the houses you can't. You own your house, but you can't sell it.
Okay.
You can trade it.
That's sort of like being in Las Vegas. the Havana
different
of the Southwest.
Different reason.
But, yeah, how were you treated as an American? I mean, you weren't there as a journalist at all, right? You weren't identified as such. What was the response from people when they found out you were from, one, America, and two, from Las Vegas?
Well, we found it right away, quickly. Americans have no problem. No problem. It's just too close. We're just, they don't see the American people as the same as the American government. We went to the Revolutionary Museum, which is in downtown Cuba, and there are all the signs of the exhibits from when Castro fought in the jungles and all the various stages of that. Then as you're leaving, there's this giant caricature of four presidents that, you know, with the horns and you know, the swastikas and those kinds of things. They see the administrations, but not the people. So that was okay. But then the minute you say you're from Las Vegas, it's magic. But it's almost like around the world, you say Las Vegas and people want to talk to you. How is it? You know. So being from Las Vegas is the door opener.
It's the same anywhere you go. When you say you're from Las Vegas, the conversation doesn't stop. It starts, right? And it's the same there. It's amazing how we're perceived abroad. I've heard people say that repeatedly. anywhere they go. Let's talk a little bit about how you got to be at the NBC affiliate here in town, and how that came to be. You were working at Channel 8 for decades.
For decades. Started there in 1967 and had a it's a wonderful operation, a wonderful station, great people over there, great company. There was a time that I just was going to retire.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to retire, there was a non-compete, like is common in...
Yeah, what were the stipulations? You were not able to work in the market for a couple of years, year and a half?
For a year, for another television station. And I understood that was fair, and as I knew, you know, most of the, quote, secrets of KLAS after, you know, 40-plus mm-hmm. years.
You had the playbook, right? Is that what they say?
But the playbooks change, as mm-hmm. the entire media is changing. So after a year, Jim and Ralph Todd, who was the president of what was then Sunbelt, all the Jim Rogers stations, called me, and we had lunch, and we talked about the direction that Jim and Ralph and Lisa Howfield want to take mm-hmm. the television station. And I said, that sounds great. That's what, count me in.
All right, Lisa being the station
general manager. Of Channel 3.
And what did they say to you that really perked your ears specifically? I mean, and Jim Rogers, as we know, is a gunslinging guy, and he's a very persuasive man. Had you had many dealings with him before this all started?
Just as a fellow broadcaster, so to speak, we had talked. We enjoyed each other's company. Primarily, it was discussion about business, about media, but never socially. But certainly followed his career as chancellor, he was quick to put his money where his mouth was, and he was not afraid to take on difficult challenges, whether it's the hospital, the UMC, or whatever mm-hmm. it is.
He's given away a lot of money, as you know. He would be a billionaire if he hadn't given away as much as he has over the years.
Well, one of the reasons I came back to answer your question. He is tired of 30-second sound bites. He wants to do news really of substance. And that includes the 5-minute interviews that he does every day.
Yes.
Includes John Ralston, includes mm-hmm. some other local programming that we are going to be putting on the air. We just launched this past Saturday another statewide broadcast out of Reno with somebody that works for both the Las Vegas Sun and Jenna Damon. She started. Mm-hmm. She works. She's a columnist for the Las Vegas Sun.
Yeah, she's a terrific political reporter.
Mm-hmm. And so we've started her with a half-an-hour program, and we'll see where that may go.
And Anjanette's program will be based in Reno.
Based in Reno,
run statewide.
It's run statewide. A little bit more of a northern Nevada perspective, but not that much, since the state clearly, because of the economy, we have all had to. You know, that line that crossed northern Nevada and southern Nevada right around Tonopah, that line is disappearing.
The Tonopah parallel?
because of the recession, we're all right. in the same boat. So we're now working on the state legislative session, which will begin in about 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a challenge. And so we're looking at those kinds of programs, those kinds of issues that Jim says, this is where I would like to go. Ralph said, this is the kind of vision that we have. And we've been working towards that.
Yeah, and in the interest of disclosure, we're talking about Greenspun Media Group and Las Vegas Sun individuals. We have some sort of a converging relationship with Channel 3 as it stands now. Even I'm not sure exactly what it is, but there is some kind of...
Converging is a nice phrase. We're working on that. We've just installed and opened up a link between the Las Vegas Sun newsroom and mm-hmm. and Channel 3. We opened that up this past week.
Yep, it was on election night. We had reporters on, a couple of our editors.
And that's those are the first steps. We share a couple of reporters, Anjanette and Denise Beidel. Denise
yes.
is a reporter for
yep.
us. We share her.
She was with us at she did 702.tv in the brief time it was a part of our operation at the Greenspun newsroom.
So mm-hmm. we're trying to look for where the synergies are,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the opportunities are to join forces, still maintain our own identities of Channel 3 and the Nevada Information Network and the Las Vegas Sun, but there are clearly opportunities with the internet and a variety of things that just really are not. available for discussion because we're still talking about
it. Right, right. And in general, I know that one of the areas we're all investigating pretty aggressively is in terms of social media, in terms of Facebook and Twitter, and getting reaching an audience that way. As someone who you're originally a you worked for the Review Journal even before
I swept the floors. Swept the floors and gathered up all the lead because we would
leads and slugs.
We would make the reuse the lead, and I always thought it was interesting. I got to sweep the floors, and the other thing on my job description was hand set the headlines of the newspaper.
Oh man!
And I, that was but that lasted for 4 or 5 months.
I think that might be under the title Lost Art.
Yes,
you're listening to Our Metropolis. This is John Katzelmeetis with Bob Stoldall, the executive vice president of KSNV Channel 3. Yeah, my question leads to somebody who has been, you know, is certainly have the underpinnings of traditional journalism, whether it's broadcast or print. What do you think of the way that the media is moving into these social media forums, Facebook, Twitter especially? Have you embraced it? Are you on Twitter?
Yes. Okay. I'll just ratchet back a little bit. Landmark Communication, which owned Channel 8, also purchased a CBS affiliate in Nashville while they were developing the Weather Channel. And I went down there for a few years. And while I was down, this is about 1995, 96, I had the sound of the squealing pig on the internet. And I just had it installed. And within a couple of hours, I was reading the Dead Sea Scrolls in Israel. And I said, this has a future. The internet has a future.
What year was this?
About 95, 96.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Now that's right at the
and so it was so exciting at that moment, and that excitement and that energy continues. Now, whether it's Facebook or whether it's Twitter, I'm not sure the people really need to know what I'm doing at any given moment, sitting on the porch, having a bottle of water, looking at the sky. Then there's also the concern that Twitter's all just going to become commercial programming. We're mm-hmm. still all of this is just finding its way. MySpace, Facebook. It's wonderful for my friends, for my family. Then you start seeing it being commercialized. But then on the other hand, how are they going to keep this running if there's not some commercial?
Right.
So all of those things are in play, and I'm up about 4:30 in the morning. The TV goes on. I go get the newspaper. The computer goes on, and I'm on there for an hour and a half in the morning, getting the day, mm-hmm. looking at the information. And the internet, as everybody knows, is just exploding with data. Mm-hmm. It's just exploding with niche programming to where I can go find what I want to know about Las Vegas history.
Above television and newspapers, is the internet your first go-to source of information these days? You go to a website first, you go to your own or one of the local Las Vegas websites before you open a paper, before you turn on the TV?
Let me see if there's an order. TV's easy. That's a click. It's on. Coffee goes on. Walk out to get the newspaper. Come over. Turn on the computer. I'm multitasking at that moment.
You've got it covered.
and there goes the tweeter right to right there. And let's see if there's anything exciting.
Well, as we talked here, Bob, I sent out a Twitter update that I was talking to you about Twitter. I sent that out on my Twitter field. This is where media has led us, my friend. So I don't know, what's your Twitter account?
This one, well, the Twitter, I'm only Twittering for a few very close friends.
How many followers do you have?
I absolutely love that state Senate Democrats changed the taxation committee to the revenue committee. That's Ralston, John Ralston, yeah. just tweeted that out.
Yeah, I've got that too. Yeah. Revenue committee in quotes.
So they changed it from taxation to revenue committee. That's like calling the peacekeeper missile.
Tax by any other name is the hashtag. John's great to follow. He's, of course, I mean, he's great at everything he does.
And
he's a good person to follow on Twitter.
Like yourself, there's a person that really aggressively uses social media. Over the weekend, he was twittering about the football games, and so I haven't decided that that's where I want to spend a lot of my time at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm still more a gatherer of data, I have plenty of vehicles where I can get the information distributed, whether it's through the TV station. The one thing I'm working on is my own website. I've registered several names. My favorite one is BigfootNote.com. Mm-hmm. I also own
BigfootNote.
BigFootNote.
Oh, BigFootNote. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
Footnote was gone, so I went, BigFootNote's not gone, so I took that. I have WeShallOver.com, Vegas Reporter, LV Hip.
Okay.
Which actually I got just for history and progress. Which is what I want my website to be, but LV Hip was still available, so I went and hit. So I got 30 or 40 names that I've registered just to...
And where are you in this process? Just
registering the names.
That's it. Getting the name down.
We're a little bit further than that. But
you are, as you've noticed, we'll dive into this a little bit. A historian for Las Vegas and interested in the history of this city. I've known you. You were part of the preservation of the El Court or the La Concha sign, where they had an event at the plaza at one point or another. We talked about this. Explain that passion. Do you feel it's really important for those for people who have lived here for a very long time to really be aggressive about saving this city's history?
Well, we're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not aggressive at all. We're a boomtown. And the challenge is going to be as you drive up and down the strip, remember Steve Wynn saying we have to reinvent ourselves. He said we have to reinvent our casinos, our hotels every 5 years. Well, that was fine when you had acres and acres of empty space on the Las Vegas Strip, and he could go across the street, knock down, in a sense, the desert in, buy the land all around it, and build the Wynn up. But how we're going to reinvent, what are we going to preserve on the Las Vegas Strip? Well, we've lost the El Rancho.
Yes.
We've lost the Frontier. We've lost the Thunderbird. We've lost the Sands. We haven't lost the Flamingo, but it's really gone because of the facade.
Mm-hmm.
We've saved the post office downtown. We saved Las Vegas High School. We've saved the railroad cottages. We're trying to save the Kyle Ranch in North Las Vegas. Some neighborhoods in the downtown area, the John S. Park, which just won an award, is preserving the neighborhood. This is really on their own. They formed the neighborhood association, went through all the hoops, and it's now a historic neighborhood. Property values go up when you do that. There's a stabilization of the community. And the mayor and the city council also recognize in order for downtown Las Vegas redevelopment to really be alive, it has to have people. It has to have stores. And it has to have – so they've encouraged neighborhoods to be preserved, not to be bulldozed. Really a progressive city council with the mayor leading in that regard.
Right. He's been a proponent of all of everything you've talked about. What do you think, for example, what do you think of the Mob Museum project, the one downtown?
Little conflict of interest here, since I've been with the Mob Museum since it was not much more than an idea.
Right. So you're still involved.
I'm still on their board. And I think that the community is going to be more than pleasantly surprised at what they see in there. Clearly, the concern that we're going to romanticize the mob, that's not there. Ellen Knowlton, who's a former FBI agent, she's the chairman of our board. And we brought in the people that built the Rock and Roll Museum in Cleveland.
The Berries. Kathy and Dennis.
The exactly right. The folks, they were also involved in the Spy Museum, and they also did the Michael Jackson event in London a couple of months ago.
They know what they're doing.
So these are quality folks. I originally got involved with the post office to help preserve the building, and from that point on, it was to help keep the story straight. Bugsy Siegel did not invent Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. He didn't. If you want to say anybody invented Las Vegas, I think you'd have to put the. I was going to say Halo. You'd have to put the patch on Meyer Lansky. I think he was the visionary, so to speak.
The more I learn about Las Vegas, the more a lot of roads end up with Meyer Lansky as someone who he wasn't a dynamic figure, but he was in a lot of ways the brains behind the intuitive brain behind a lot of what came to Las Vegas in those in the late 50s, early 60s.
So I think the community is this is not a museum for 5 and 6 year olds. Mm-hmm. This is a museum that's going to have an edge. It traces the history of Las Vegas from the earliest days, and we move up into Prohibition, where organized crime really developed and grew because of the prohibition against alcohol, and there people wanted to buy it, so they needed to form all these operations to deliver it, produce it, and deliver it. Then it goes through the challenges that Las Vegas faced in its growth years. Certainly we attracted all the folks that knew how to gamble, that knew how to run a gaming business. And yeah, it was illegal in mm-hmm. the rest of the United States. So there is that effort to cleanse themselves of their past, but yet hang on to it, donate to charities and build hospitals and those kinds of things. Well, there's Mo Dalitz and that crew. Mm-hmm. You'll find people that said Mo Dalitz was a gentleman, was this, and then you'll find some folks who will clearly say, yeah, but here was his record in Cleveland.
There's always that undercarriage of the criminal conduct at some point or another with all these figures and studying them. On this historic front, Bob, as you were talking, there, because I've been covering the closing and the reconstituting of the Liberace Museum.
Yes.
How come there wasn't a bigger outcry about the closing of that?
I think Liberace was for a select generation. He wasn't. If you check Liberace's history, you will see that he was in the 40s, and this is a man who had, I think, three or four generations at least three generations of fans. The latter years, he became almost a caricature of himself.
Mm-hmm.
An Elvis Museum, a Liberace Museum. Which one's going to close first? The Liberace Museum. I mean, you have to make that kind of a decision. Would there be a Sophie Tucker Museum?
I hear what you're
one
saying.
Of the things is a good way to judge things. One way, go on eBay, see what a Liberace autograph goes for, see what a Carol Lombard autograph goes for, see what a Clark Gable goes for, a James Dean, a Marilyn Monroe. There is this sort of ebb and flow of the value of and some exactly. of them last generations, others peak and go away. That would, just to use your word, that were icons, have disappeared. And I think for some reason that Liberace fell into that category. Whether it was because he was gay, I don't think so. Whether it was because he was no longer appealed to a contemporary audience, I can't answer your question.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think all of that has definitely played into this. It's a very interesting dynamic down there, and what happened with the Liberace Museum, and it's socially, locally, and artistically. It was a very interesting.
But all museums are having the mm-hmm. budget for the state museums that were the productive budget or the existing budget looks for closing five of the seven museums in the state of Nevada.
Ouch. We can do a whole show about that, too. We do have to close this one out, though, Bob. That was 30 minutes, yes. I thank you for coming down here. It's always a pleasure to talk to you in any context. And, we'll definitely have you on again. For all of us at Arm and Shopless, this is John Katzlamitas reminding you to stay tuned for Observations.
Thank you for joining us for Our Metropolis. Join us again next Tuesday at 6 p.m. for Our Metropolis.